WFVR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont. Get bonus points if you can name the gentleman playing banjo on this piece, joining the Steep Canyon Rangers. Well, excuse me. There, that's your clue. This is Green Zine, your weekly environmental on-air audio environmental magazines. I said environmental twice, but hey. We got to sustain the environment. This piece is called Rare Bird Alert. Henry Swayze is on the line. He'll be joining me. We have a couple of guests today. And only 58 minutes to go. Green Zine is brought to you by the good folks. Well, a lot of people contributed to the Yes We Can Collective. We round up a bunch of redeemable cans, mostly, but sometimes bottles that can be redeemed in Vermont. And it slowly adds up. Also, we want to thank Wit and Grit, a breakfast and restaurant in Randolph, Vermont. Solarfest, they're having a gathering of insiders next week to look at some future projects that they're working on, including maybe bringing back the festival next summer. First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Leibowitz, Solaflect, Bale getting behind a big event, No King's Day, on the green here in South Royalton on Saturday, the 18th of October from 1 to 3 p.m. And finally, Tom Wells. All right, Henry, since I know that I've got your attention, can you name that banjo player that was just playing?
Yeah, no, but that's partly because I really don't hear the music very well at my end.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not on the radio.
Interesting. So. You don't hear the music, but you hear my voice and you hear the guest voice. That's the main thing.
Yeah, it's the board does a really good job with voices. So that's, think, you know, if I wasn't listening on the telephone, I was listening on over the
stream.
Internet.
Yeah, it would be okay. Yeah.
Clearly.
Well, anyway, it was Steve Martin, a well-known comedian, writer, poet, cartoonist, artist, and he also is quite expert on the banjo. And that piece is a title to an album. He did a collaborative with Steep Canyon Rangers out of North Carolina, Rare Bird Alert. And I think we're going to be talking about birds here shortly.
We are, indeed. Yes, we have... Maeve Kim joining us again. She's been a guest other years to talk about bird migration, or especially birds getting ready for the winter. I guess that was what she really wanted to talk about. She's been up in the Northeast Kingdom looking at birds migrating through there, songbirds that are on the move down from Canada into southern climes.
Yeah, a lot of migration. I woke up in the night, and just in the very distance, I could tell they were at very high altitude. I did hear the geese on the move at about 3 a.m.
Yeah. Well, they must have had the winds at their back.
They did. They were making their way. Well, as we discussed beforehand, before we let you go to get Maeve on the line, the Herald is really just chock full of what local organizations are doing to have to do with our environment, our natural world, helping people get out into the natural world. And on the front page, this is a property I'm very familiar with. It's just above East Bethel. It's on Christian Hill Road, And the Vermont Land Trust has gotten involved. The late couple that unfortunately perished in a fire back in 2022, Davis Dimmick and Victoria Weber, their property has been taken over by the Vermont Land Trust. And is it open to visits by the public? There aren't any trails. There's no benches to hang around. But as far as going and looking at some of the standing stone and structures that Davis Dimmick put together, it's a very unique place. And the deal has been finalized. A representative from Vermont Land Trust goes that their goal is to keep maintaining the land and doing some ecological restoration work so that it'll be in the best possible shape for visitors. They will eventually sell it, but it will, and it might take a couple years before they're ready to do that, but it will, the conservation easement will remain in effect. So I'm just going to get to the end of this article and give you the address, because you're allowed to go out there. Today, in addition to Dimmick and Weber's gardens and rock formations, personal touches abound at this spot that I didn't know that they named it, the original owners, Scrivelsby. That sounds like a character from a Dickens novel. Scrivelsby. Among other symbols, a Ukrainian flag flies on a grassy bank, a rainbow decal sticks to a window in a shed, and a small wreath hangs over the hearth of a still-standing stone fireplace. If you want to visit, and you could do it like on a bike loop up that way, here's the address. It's the Weber Dimmock property. That's D-I-M-O-C-K, and it's located at 2937 Christian Hill. And the Vermont Land Trust has put a sign up there. So that's some local news. I'm going to move into this other page. Oh, yeah, this one's of interest to me. I might even be attending it. So coming up, this coming Tuesday, the 14th of October, the Bethel Conservation Commission will be presenting a free public event from 6 to 7:30 at the Bethel Town Hall, you know, that restored brick building right in the middle of town. In this presentation, Al Freeman, Vermont's climate forester, will take those attending on a journey through the history and future of Vermont's forests, considering how they may adapt in the face of climate change and evolving management practices. This event will be of particular interest to landowners and Vermonters concerned about the health of local forests. Guest speaker Al Freeman works with Vermont Forests, Parks and Recreation, serving as a resource on climate adaptation and carbon science for both private and state lands. Anything else? Let's see. No, I think that's going to do. Oh yeah. Contact is none other than our good friend Danny Dover. And you can contact him with an email at Tashi Delic. Well, that's an interesting one. I think that has to do with his Himalayan travels. T-A-S-H-I-D-E-L-E-K. Better than that, just get the Herald, today's Herald, and look on page A4, and you will find Tashi Delic at comcast.net. There's a couple of other local things that we may touch towards the end of the show, Henry, but I'm going to leave those there. I do want to ask you about how things are doing. As we got some rain, there's some rain coming up, I think, next week. How's the lake looking? There was a story that Vermont Digger put out about how low Lake Champlain is. You have a report for us on the waterways up there?
Yeah, I had some excitement with the lake yesterday. We decided we would get our pontoon boat off the river because it was that section of the Lamoille River that we dock it on is basically controlled at this time of year by lake level. And the lake level didn't go up, or if it did, it only went up an iota. I freed up the boat from the dock and picked the motor up and pushed it out. Barely enough water to float it, and headed downstream. But the stream in the channels that had water were moving much faster because of that rain shot we got.
Okay.
So getting it onto a trailer and out of the river was actually quite tricky because it was faster moving water than it is all summer long.
Uh-huh.
So there's water feeding in, but hasn't. I you know, we have more rain coming over this next week. We're not rainless. Maybe we haven't. We won't have hit the all-time record low set back in, I think, 1908 for the lake. But, boy, we're really close to it.
Yeah, that's not a record you want to break. Let's leave that one in place. Yeah. Hey, it's about 10 minutes into the show here. I know that you were going to try to get our initial guest on the line.
I have Maeve on the line, and we're going to talk birds. So, Maeve, welcome to Greenzine.
Thank you again. I've been here before and liked it. Yeah, it's a good time to talk birds and winter, because this morning is really cold. We had a heavy frost. We've brought in all our tomatoes and our peppers. We've eaten the last zucchini, finally. Our wool shed is full.
How big was that last zucchini?
The last actually wasn't a monster. We have had a few that were baseball bat sized, but the last one was only about as big as my arm.
Nice.
It was. It was a great splash here. So birds, they have to deal with Vermont winters too, and a lot of them cope the same way some humans do. They just leave. For birds whose main diet is insects or fruit or nectar, there's basically nothing to keep them alive when the temperatures start dropping this low. So those birds spend late summer and early fall bulking up, because they're going to have migrations that are going from a few hundred miles to several thousand miles. So a lot of these guys go through this phase called hyperphagia, or maybe it's hyperphagia, I don't know. But it's basically intense all-day, everyday eating. And, for instance, hummingbirds can add 40% to their body weight in a couple of weeks.
Mm.
I know, you don't even think of a fat hummingbird. But they need all that extra fat, because when they get to Central South America, which is where they're heading, they will be nothing but skin and bones and feather. They will start actually living off their muscle. So, you know, they really need that extra. All of our insectivorous birds, the birds that eat insects, have already left Vermont. That includes eastern phoebes and swifts and swallows, all the birds with the name flycatcher in their name. Almost all of our warblers and vireos and orioles and catbirds and thrushes have left too, which makes it a quieter landscape and a less active landscape, but there's still quite a lot. And there are a lot of birds that are here in the winter, and they've had to figure out really interesting ways to make it. One of my favorite, and I didn't know this for the many, many first years I was a birder, is black-capped chickadees.
Mm-hmm.
They're so cute. They're one of the most common and most familiar birds, and they prepare for the change of seasons in a truly amazing way. They change the very structure of their brains. Chickadees eat mostly insects in the summer, and they actually feed insects to their young exclusively. But then they switch to seeds in late summer and early fall, and they store hundreds and hundreds of seeds for eating during the winter, every one in a different spot, and every chickadee remembers all those hundreds of hiding places, which requires really sophisticated spatial memory.
Wow.
But by next spring, they don't need that spatial memory anymore. They don't need to remember locations. All they need to do, their only jobs, are really reproduction at that time. So every spring, chickadees get rid of the neurons that govern spatial memory, and then they regrow them again every fall, which I think is just amazing.
Wow.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. So it probably takes energy for them to rebuild their brains like that, too. I wonder whether that has anything to do with their conservation that way.
I think it must take quite a lot, yeah. And it certainly helps them. I mean, they've got tiny little brains, if you think about it. But the constant replacement of neurons lets them deal with all different kinds of intellectual challenges that the different seasons bring. Scientists are beginning to think that studying them might give some hope for people with Alzheimer's. that there might be a way that we can regrow neurons when we need them and regrow brain cells, which would be, you know, a major breakthrough, to put it mildly.
Yeah, well, we definitely, I mean, I know when I'm exercising my brain thinking about climate challenges or whatever it is I'm working on, that sometimes it's hard thinking about those things at first, and it gets easier as you've been doing it, a new puzzle game or whatever. Those things all stretch your brain and add extra connections.
That's true. I keep reading about, like, knitting. Complicated knitting patterns are supposed to be a good sort of anti-Alzheimer's, not necessarily Alzheimer's, because that's a specific disease, but it's just really good for your brain. Yeah,
yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because we just celebrated the 37th annual Vermont Sheep and Wool Festival here at the Tunbridge Fairgrounds, and you want to see a lot of people knitting in an area for the entire weekend, and able sort of multitasking, knitting,
talking, doing
all kinds of other things at the same time. I don't think I can recalibrate my brain to that.
I can't either. We have a neighbor who was at that festival up until only a few years ago. She just had her 96th or 7th birthday, and she was a sheep. She ran sheepdogs. That's what she did for decades and decades and decades. And man, she's sharp. She's losing it a bit now, but you know, by 97, she sort of has a right.
definitely have that.
She's slowing down.
I don't know. The new 100 is the old 80, I think.
I hope so.
We're figuring out how to stretch it out.
I hope so. I really do. So going on to other birds, there are other birds that hide food for the winter, seeds and nuts also. Nuthatches and tufted titmice and woodpeckers. Blue jays can hold as many as 5 acorns in their throat at one time.
Whoa.
To carry the nuts, which is pretty amazing. Yeah, this group of scientists, I can't remember what state this was, but they fitted a bunch of blue jays with radio transmitters, and then they followed the birds for a couple of days, several days actually, and they found out that every one of those birds hid between 3,000 and 5,000 nuts in one fall.
Wow.
I know. I haven't found anything about whether blue jays also lose the neurons responsible for spatial reasoning or spatial memory and then regrow them. In fact, I found that blue jays are so common, and there's a huge amount of them that isn't even known yet. Scientists now think that as many as 20% of blue jays are migratory, and the majority stay put, and no one knows why. And no one knows why some leave and some. But if you're on the lake, you've been on the river, Henry, more than the lake, but people out on the Broad Lake will very often see flights of 80 or 90 blue jays heading south in the fall, which is weird.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I've never seen a flock of blue jay migrating like that. Have you? Have you seen them migrate?
Once. I can't remember what it's maybe UVM, every now and then has fall tours on the I can't remember what their research boat is, the Mellosira.
Right.
And one year, it was just a constant stream of blue jays going over our head. It was just weird. I don't think anybody on board has seen that before. But that's the only time I've ever seen that.
Wow. So some birds of the same species, I think chickadees can be like this. Maybe the orange-breasted chickadees will migrate somewhat south, a modest migration, 100, 200 miles kind of thing, and then some of the other ones are staying put, and maybe it's not chickadees. Maybe that's not a good example. But can you explain why some of those birds migrate, even though they're birds that frequently winter over?
I wish I could. I mean, there's scientists working on that. You're right. There's some that just, Carolina wrens are a kind of wren that's fairly new to northern Vermont, but their numbers are increasing. some of them just stay put, and other ones continue migrating back down to Pennsylvania or Virginia or so, and no one really knows the difference. I mean, there have been studies looking at DNA and looking at fat, you know, and a lot of other possible differences between the ones that migrate and the ones that not, and nothing has shown up so far. And then the reverse is true, too. A few hardy yellow-rumped warblers and even some hermit thrushes overwinter here in the North Country, especially if the summer had good wild grapes and elderberries and highbush cranberry and serviceberry, et cetera, and they just live on that. It's like they figure migration is arduous. It's fraught with peril. If I don't have to do it this year, I'm not going to, which is really very individualistic. And robins, wow. They're often here in the winter. We don't see them as often, but they're here. They just spend part of every day roosting in trees to conserve energy, so we don't see them hopping around on snow-covered lawns. So
what do robins eat in the winter? I mean, they're out there doing bugs, a lot of bug eating
right.
in the summer, aren't they? Worms and...
Exclusively bug eating in the summer. They will eat rotting seed or softened seed, and they will eat grubs, and they can find quite a lot of grubs in rotting wood
in the winter
right they're not feeding young, so they don't eat, and they, as I said, they're still most of every day, which conserves precious energy, but it still feels weird to see a group of robins in February. I gotta say. And we've got birds that stay here that don't store anything and don't migrate, like mourning doves. They have to find new food all the time. They have to eat up to 20% of their body weight every single day just to stay alive. It just amazes me that they do.
Yeah, and particularly if we have heavy snow cover. I've seen the mourning doves out there. What are they? Are they going up into the trees and getting leftover seeds, or what are they eating?
One of the nicest things we can do for mourning doves is not clean up our flowers in the fall. If you leave goldenrod and everything like that, there's a lot of seed on all that, and grasses, too, have a lot of seed. And they will find it, and they will eat. They'll just gobble. They'll just fill their whole throat with seed, as many as, I don't know, 300 or 400, I remember reading, or 3,000 or 4,000. And then they'll go up to a tree and just sit there all day digesting what they ate earlier that day.
And take a nap.
But some
after
do
that,
die. Yeah. I mean, every single year, some birds don't make it through our winters.
Of the number of eggs that are laid in a nest and how the population only holds even or gains or loses a little bit. So there's got to be a lot of fatalities.
That's a good point. And there are fatalities for the ones that migrate, too, because there's a lot of danger in migration. And it's a really long, long flight.
You think of your hummingbird example, that the hummingbird, after bulking up 40% of its body weight, lands at the other end working on its muscles for energy.
I know.
So that must be a photo finish, that they have enough muscle left to still fly or not.
That's a good example of photo finish. I mean, some of our ruby-throated hummingbirds fly nonstop across the Gulf of Mexico. Well, that last 200 or 300 miles is just desperation, the poor little guys. And yet, you're right, there are enough of them to come back the next year and delight us. That's what they do. Other things that allow the birds to survive is, during our winter, things like the birds that stay here, is those really thick feathers. They can fluff them out, and they can create air pockets like insulation. And they also can tuck their heads and feet into their feathers at night. They've got some ideas. And they team up. You've probably heard of Vermont scientist and professor and writer Bernd Heinrich.
Yes.
Well, he wondered about really tiny little birds called golden-crowned kinglets. They're even smaller than chickadees. And they live through the coldest days in the Northeast Kingdom, which, you know, is the coldest part of our state. And he kept wondering, how can they survive? I mean, they weigh, I think it's 0.2 ounce each. Two tenths of an ounce. So he found out that...
Must be less than a nickel.
Yeah, I think we could mail them to each other for, you know, a bunch of them in an envelope for one stamp. He found out they gather together in groups at night. They start looking for each other as the sun falls so they can share body heat, which is really smart.
We did a bird note on one of our other programs, previous programs that had said that chickadees will, on the really coldest nights, will gather in a hollow tree and sometimes pack a dozen chickadees all into the same space to stay warm.
I did not know that about chickadees. In fact, I just read yesterday that they don't team up and that they almost always sleep alone, in his or her individual cavity, but the cavities are lined with rotting wood, which provides insulation, but also the very process of rotting releases some heat. So I'll have to do some more investigation and see about this.
I'll double check. Maybe I have the breed wrong, the bird wrong, but I will send you a link to that. I'm sure I can find that.
Good, good. Definitely golden crown kinglets. Some of them actually use snow itself. Ruffed grouse use the snow as an insulating blanket. I was out back once cross-country skiing, and I got scared out of my wits when this huge fat bird erupted from under the tips of my skis with this huge, loud whirring of wings. It woke me up.
Must have been a non-packed trail. No one had been there before you.
That's true. That is absolutely true. And there are little tiny birds called redpolls, and they use snow. One February morning, it was really cold, and I looked outdoors, and the snow on the barn roof was heaving, and I couldn't figure out what was happening. And then one, and then two, and then 15 redpolls came out from under the snow and shook themselves off and headed down to the feeders. So they'd been...
Wow.
Spending the night. I didn't know they did that. They come only to Vermont only every third winter or something, but they're lovely little birds.
So I wonder, you were mentioning that the chickadees shift from bug eating to seed eating. Do you think that's true for many of the birds that overwinter?
Yes. Huge numbers. Woodpeckers go on finding bugs. They'll eat seeds every now and then at bird feeders, but they really prefer insects. Pileated woodpeckers, you've seen them, those huge holes they make in trees. They're hunting for carpenter ants. That's their most favorite food. And they'll find grubs in there, too. And hairy woodpeckers and downy woodpeckers still find insects to eat. But they're, insects are... there aren't many flying insects, so that does away with all the swallows and everything in the winter. And so the other one, most of our smaller birds exclusively feed insects to their young, but then they're more, they have wider diets once fall comes, and they will eat basically, fruits, vegetables, fruits, seeds, and insects if they can find some. They've got to be generalists a little bit.
So things we can do to make it so birds overwinter better. I'm thinking you were saying leave goldenrod and don't clean up, don't be so tidy about your landscape. Any other recommendations for making for better winter survival for our birds?
Well, if you put bird houses out in the spring, you could clean them out, and sometimes birds will roost in there in the winter. Of course, mice also do so, and red squirrels and flying squirrels, but that can help a lot. And feeding birds, you're not going to damage them. You're not going to make them dependent on humans, but you can help some survive that might not have survived otherwise if you can put out food in a safe manner. And oddly enough, providing water. You don't want to put water out when it's incredibly cold, because the birds will drink it as soon as you put it out, and then it's not good for them. It's going to lower their body heat.
Mm.
But birds, they can eat snow, but that lowers their body heat too. So if you can put out water several times a day and put it out slightly warm, you'll see birds really enjoying it, flocking to it. But I think the most important thing is having lots of plants that they can eat off. A lot of plants that have nuts and fruit on them, and then leaving your seeds. Even burdock, which most of us rip out of our yards. I spent years trying to fight burdock on my yard before I discovered that it's one of the major winter foods for goldfinches and several other species, the burdock seed, which I had no idea. So, yeah, you sort of got to think like a bird, and, you know, what are they looking at in this, in our backyards, and are they seeing anything that welcomes them and helps them? But,
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot that we can be doing. And the most important probably is planting native plants that have nuts and berries.
Right. Once again, the interactivity of the plant world, the animal world, and the human world, and hopefully in a beneficial way. Maeve, we've reached the bottom of our first half hour. I want to thank you here from the studio for all of the knowledge that you've passed along and your conversation with Henry. It's great to have you on the air with us on Green Zine.
Thank you. It's fun to chat with you guys.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's excellent. And appreciate the fact that you're willing to be ricocheted from one subject to another.
All I'm doing is talking about birds, and talking about birds is fun.
It certainly is. All right. Look forward to talking with you again.
We'll definitely check in with you another season.
Okay. Good. Bye, Todd.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Henry, I'm going to bring you down in the mix because I'm going to be doing one more bird thing, and then we're going to play a piece of music that has a lot to do with our next guest here. We're going to be talking styrofoam here on Green Zine in just a little bit. We got about 28 minutes left in the show. This just in the last few days from an organization that's based down in Norwich, and we've talked to some of their scientists and experts. It is the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. And the note that they sent to me, and I'm sure to a bunch of other folks, it's that time of year. The VCE researchers are eagerly watching to see when migratory birds like the Bicknell's thrush, bird shorthand is BITH, B-I-T-H, will start their perilous journey south to Latin America. Could happen just about any day. But VCE wondered, why do they want to keep all that fun and information to themselves? They're inviting the public to join them as part of their VCE Bicknell thrush research. And basically, we're going to try to figure out who's going to leave the East Coast on their migratory flight first. During the breeding season, their scientists tagged 19 different Bicknell's thrushes near the top of Mount Mansfield, Vermont's highest mountain, as these birds fitted with tiny receiver backpacks. Yep, that's true. They leave the mountain. They will ping MODIS towers from New England to the Mid-Atlantic region and the coastal Carolinas, where they'll spend 2 weeks resting and fattening up. Then they leave land at that point. One by one, under the cover of night, they'll leave the safety of dry land and make a break for Hispaniola, more than 1,400 miles over the ocean. When they do that, they'll have one last ping on the MODIS tower, and that's the one that they're looking for. And you can participate by going to the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, and you can pick a bird. And it's kind of like being at the horse races. Who's going to leave first? And I'll just run through these birds. They've given them some pretty clever names. Autumn Owl, Balsam Betty is heading down to Hispaniola for the winter. Bag O' Balsam, Burly Ben, Captain Krumholtz, that's the one that I put my squash nickel down on. Captain Krumholtz, and of course, most of you know what Krumholtz is. Conifer Cam, Dr. Dimmer, Freddie Wetfoot, Lakeside Lady, Long Trail Larry. Of course, the Long Trail goes over Mount Mansfield, I believe, or pretty darn close. New Nelly, Nightingale Nate, Oliver the Og. Yeah. Steadfast Steve, Stowside Sally, Teardrop Tommy, Tiny Tim, Trap Happy Travis, and Wandering Walt. Well, while Henry gets connected with our next guest, and we're going to be talking, styrofoam, believe it or not, I found a very instructional song about that subject. We're going to listen to a little bit. It's from Ashley McBride. You're on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio.
A physicist named Ray McIntyre rediscovered a method first discovered by Carl Munters, an inventor from Sweden. You knew that, right? Yeah, I looked it up. Anyway, old Ray found a way to make large quantities of extrudent polystyrene in a closed-cell foam form that was resistant to moisture. But you and I know it as styrofoam, which reminds me tonight on my way home. I need to hit the quick sack, and for $5 I got myself a portable box I can fill with ice and keep all my natty lights nice and cold. You gotta love styrofoam.
Well, I'm gonna bring that down in the mix. I'm not sure that we love styrofoam as much as Ashley McBride and her natty bow lights in that container. Henry, have you been able to get a hold of our next guest?
Yes, I have Jen Durgan on the phone with us, and she has been taming styrofoam on behalf of the Hartford Climate Action Steering Team. So, Jen, welcome to Green Zine.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Yeah.
Styrofoam is incredible, as the song mentions. However, it's also takes up lots of space in landfills and has some real negative effects when it comes to putting your food in styrofoam, let's say. So what I've done and other sustainability enthusiasts in the region that we call the Upper Valley, which are the towns that border the Connecticut River on the Vermont and the New Hampshire side, is we organize these collections three times a year, and each community kind of takes over running one collection. So a lot of people don't realize that styrofoam can be recycled. It just takes a specific type of machine. So starting, I think, in 2021, Lebanon, New Hampshire was one of the first towns to pilot collecting styrofoam and then driving it to the closest specialized machine, which is in Guilford, New Hampshire. And what these machines do is they essentially chop up the styrofoam, heat the foam so it gets the air out, and then what comes out is a very dense material that can then be sold to a construction company in Canada, which is what they do with it. It can be sold for other things too, but the construction company then uses it to make foam insulation boards for buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so where is so the machine that densifies it, that melts it down, gets it into something that's compact to ship. The one you are feeding right now is kind of on overload, right? They've got about all the styrofoam they can gobble.
Yes, yes. So I think we can all agree that nobody wants more landfills, and the landfills are rapidly filling up. You know, Vermont has one in Coventry, and our region has the landfill in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And the thing about styrofoam is that when you densify it, it has a 90-to-1 ratio.
Mm.
So that is taking up a lot of space. So to give you an example, these collections that we run are 2 hours long. So in 2 hours, last Saturday, in White River Junction, Vermont, we collected 2,000 pounds of styrofoam.
Ooh, that's a tractor trailer load.
Yeah, so that filled two 26-foot U-Haul trucks to the max. It filled two 30-cubic yard Casella containers, which Casella generously donated for this, and half of a 26-foot U-Haul. So there is demand for this. I think getting back to Henry's question, Guilford, New Hampshire, for us in the Upper Valley, that's an hour and a half drive for us. So not only are we burning the gas on not very fuel-efficient vehicles, but we're traveling quite a distance. So there is one densifier in Vermont. It's in Lindenville, which is part of the Northeast Kingdom Solid Waste District. Anyone who's in that district can bring their styrofoam to the Lindenville facility, and it will be recycled. However, it's not open to towns outside of that because, like Guilford, they have as much as they can handle. Feel free to interrupt me, but go ahead. Okay. No,
well, yeah, I'll interrupt right here.
Go ahead.
I'm just curious. Only these two towns, and they're both pretty far away. And just as an example about landfills filling up, I spend some time in the summer on the mid coast of Maine, and almost every week there's a story in the local paper there about the local transfer station that they're trying to make a deal with a local place landfill that's closed, and the option for people on the coast of Maine, if that gets closed, is shipping their stuff into New Hampshire, more than 3 hours away to take that. So the landfill issue is pretty serious. And now to go back to the Lindenville and the Guilford densifier locations, once they have that specialized equipment, once they get that compacted and they're selling it right to the Canadian construction companies. I mean, is there like a little income stream for those densifier owners?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the actual machine, the sizes they use to get the whole unit and the container it comes in and everything is about $100,000, which you can pay for largely with grants. And it's kind of a one-time expense. The real expense comes in the labor of feeding the machine. So you need two people. So it's a fairly slow process in many senses because it takes several hours to process many large bags of foam. So Guilford, New Hampshire has really been a pioneer in the country working in with a company called Foam Cycle, which was started in New Jersey, and they have these patented densifier machines. And so Guilford, who's led by the Guilford Department of Public Works, which is led by a woman named Megan, she's done calculations to show that where you'd save money is in the hauling costs. So, you know, almost all towns in Vermont have to haul their waste. So she's seen about, you save some money in hauling costs, and then you do make some money selling it. So for a sense of what they're making about $12,000 to $13,000 a year, which is great, but it certainly doesn't equal a staff person. It's really the staffing. And we've met in the Upper Valley. We've met with the solid waste managers and Department of Public Works directors in our area, and everyone agrees nobody wants us going into the landfill, but it's going to require additional staffing. So I think that it's really incumbent on communities to educate each other, to advocate for these things, and to fully fund their solid waste districts, because all of these collections are being run by volunteers and volunteer organizations.
Well, I was thinking, speaking of volunteers, and we're real big on this, this is an all-volunteer radio station, is that, and I know there's legal and liability issues and stuff, but maybe if you had a very strong multi-staff volunteer energy committee or your solid waste district could round people up, that feeding time, like you say, takes multiple hours to just feed the machines. If you had volunteers doing that, another way to save money and maybe up that income level a little bit more.
I completely agree. I think it depends on the various rules of where it is located. So Lebanon, New Hampshire, for example, their rules don't allow them to have volunteers on their premises working. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, that won't work for our region. However, if there was a densifier in central Vermont where they could have volunteers, we would gladly bring our phone there.
Okay, we'll work on that behind the scenes. Yeah, another project for you, Henry.
That's interesting.
Hey, it's only $100,000. Hey, we could you know have a bake sale or something. Yeah.
Yeah, right? But I think there are funding agencies to help with it.
Yeah, the grants would be helpful. Go ahead, Henry.
Yeah, I'm just scratching my brain and thinking about Royalton Transfer Station and Tunbridge Transfer Station and. I don't know whether Bethel rings, and you must have something going on in Randolph.
Towns. So as far, I'm part of a regional foam action group, and as far as we know, the community collections are mostly happening in the Upper Valley, and we're not aware of any collections further into Vermont. There are state representatives who are interested in getting a densifier in Vermont. So I would encourage folks to talk to their representatives in the Vermont State House and their town officials.
Yeah, well, I know a particular representative who has been on this show a few times, and we will, and she is a senator in Vermont. We'll talk to her about this. Go ahead, Henry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great. I just will tell a little story. I had my wife and I moved to Vermont in 1965. So before most of our listeners were probably born, and the Hanover Co-op was just one store at that time. And they had a big cardboard carton in the lobby of the store, and it had a handwritten note in it: "Put your shipping peanuts in here." There was someone who was building a house and using shipping peanuts for his insulation in his walls. And at that time, there were. Everything you got in the mail came with shipping peanuts. And I know that Amazon's tried to move to more user dump-friendly packing materials than shipping peanuts. But are you seeing a lot of shipping peanuts still, or is it mostly food containers pre-molded styrofoam blocks that are being used to protect merchandise and shipping?
So we actually don't accept shipping peanuts because the Guilford facility does not accept them. It's very hard with shipping peanuts to make sure they're actually styrofoam and not some mixture of cornstarch. So we usually say if people have shipping peanuts to call local moving agencies or maple syrup producers, or there are some facilities in Massachusetts, I think, that do take peanuts. So, yes, we're largely seeing packaging around appliances, lots of coolers. So, I'm not a vegetarian, but it really irks me when I see the Omaha steak.
Oh, wow. Huge. Yeah.
Because there are some things that have to be shipped in styrofoam, but I would say that steaks do not need to be to individual houses.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy consumption of materials for
mail order steak.
Delivery.
Yeah.
I haven't had one of those, but I've heard that they might be pretty good tasting. So Any final wrap-up thoughts about the recommendations?
Well, I would say if people want to learn more about this, they can contact me, and my email is in the show notes, as well as contacting the Lindenville facility. They organized a tour about a year ago, and people came, you know, from far around the state, the Burlington area. If you want more information directly from Foam Cycle, the guy who runs it is wonderful. He can give you a breakdown of the costs, and there's trial periods. And so I believe I also put Foam Cycle in the show notes as well.
Yeah. So I guess, and just an overview of what we're trying to do, we're trying to not overload the landfills, get stuff that can be recycled out of the landfill, and styrofoam being a nice bulky one.
And because we don't want to landfill air.
You're right.
There's no reason to bury
air. Although probably if it gets deep enough, some of the air gets squeezed out of it.
That's true.
Although I used a lot of styrofoam in the roof of my earth-burned house with a lot of soil on top of it, and I've had situations to unpack that. And the styrofoam with 3 feet of soil over it doesn't get compacted very much. It's pretty much the way it went in. So the other thing we're really trying to do is to not move the styrofoam in its
long
air, you know, in its volume condition. We want to shrink it in as many locales as we can, so that we reduce that transporting 20-foot trucks of air to a densifier.
Yeah, and there are more densifiers coming online in New Hampshire. So what the larger group is envisioning is kind of a hub-and-spoke system where you would have these densifiers placed around the region and in other parts of the country as well that towns can feed into without having to travel, let's say, you know, over 50 miles.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a way of doing a pre-densifier, something inexpensive, like at the Tunbridge transfer site, there's a trash compactor, which probably doesn't squeeze hard enough to take much air out of styrofoam boxes. But I wonder if there'd be some way of...
The heat is really important. So it gets heated to a temperature where it actually becomes more of a liquid and the air is pulled out of it.
Okay.
That would be a wonderful invention.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that maybe you could cut the volume of the movement from local to the nearest densifier in half before it went as a densifier.
Well, it would be
a lot of young children that are. Can come and jump up and down on the pieces once they're in their bags.
Yeah, very good. Well, Jen, thanks for really illuminating the world of styrofoam and how we can keep using it in a refabricated by our good friends to the north in Canada. And thanks for joining us here on Green Zine.
You're welcome. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for the good work volunteering and making these things happen.
Yes, and I'm one of many people in the Upper Valley. I forgot to say that. So, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Takes team. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, just to stretch it out a little bit further, if you're listening in, you know, we mentioned the towns that were immediately adjacent to towns like Stratford and Sharon and Randolph and here in Royalton and Tunbridge, but other towns that, you know, have a lot of people that are getting styrofoam, they could go to their representatives, whether they're House or Senate representatives, and start the conversation going, and then in a group-wide effort, maybe some of these densifiers can come here. But we're going to move on from densifiers as we are down to just about 6 minutes left in the show. And here is something that's going to be a lot of fun. There's a busy weekend coming up this weekend, but the following Saturday, the 18th, a nice collaborative between the Braintree Conservation Commission and their Historical Society, and they are going to lead folks along one of Braintree's longest and most picturesque legal trails. No, there is not a lawsuit pending over that legal trail. And it connects, if you get your atlas out, Tibbetts Road to Peth Road. Now, I am familiar with Peth Road, and I probably went by Tibbetts at some point. Braintree has over 7 miles. It's one of the, has more legal trails than a lot of towns in Vermont, which are defined in Vermont, just to remind folks, as public rights of way that are not highways. Many of those trails were formerly more well-traveled town roads. The hike, which will follow the Stonebridge Trail, and it has a whole lot of details. So I'll just get to the folks that you want to call if you want to sign up and know exactly where to meet for this hike. Jackson Evans at 802-345-5684, 345-5684, or this is probably easier, and you could look this up if you don't get it all down, Braintree VT Historical Society. That's pretty easy, Braintree VT Historical Society at gmail.com. All this information can be found in our local paper of record. There's no fake news in here. It's on page A9 of this week's White River Valley Herald. Throwing it back to you, Henry.
Yeah, and so we have an upcoming event. We discussed window dressers, making those panels with blow-dry plastic on both sides that you can insert in, especially for leaky windows in old buildings. And there are many of those workshops coming up to, you could take up a station and help build these. They've already been measured and pre-cut for particular houses, but we need hands-on assembly. And they're in the show notes. There's a listing for this, but there is one at the White River Natural Resources Conservation District this Friday, October 10th.
I'll follow on this.
I'm giving you the wrong thing.
Well, I have the right thing.
It's coming up.
Yeah, it's coming up. It actually starts today, October 9th, and it's going to be up at the Bethel Town Hall, the big brick building there, and it will serve the towns of Randolph, Bethel, Rochester, Hancock, Granville, Pittsfield, Stockbridge, Northfield, Royalton, and Tunbridge. It pretty much goes all day long, right on through the weekend. Here is your key phone number to find out more about it. Once again, someone else who's been on Green Zine a couple of times. He heads up their energy committee, I believe. His name is Gene Krause, and he can be reached at 802-431-5730. I know that we have gotten the word from our previous guest on this subject, Raluca Velku, that my partner and I are going to round up some existing window dresser frames that need some repairs. But the main thing, as I think you were indicating, Henry, is they need more volunteers, more people along that assembly line to be over there in Bethel as it starts up tomorrow, actually today, and then through the early part of next week. So keep that phone number in mind for Gene Krause. And I think you'll have that in the show notes, won't you, Henry?
Yes, that is in the show notes, and I had the link to the windowdressers.org, which is organizing this across multiple states, and you can pull up the Vermont listings, and there's more of them coming. So there's one up in Corinth, and there's going to be one in Norwich, and it's a fun event. To get together with other people and kind of like a knitting circle. you can be doing some good and learning the skills to do it and enjoy with your neighbors.
Yeah.
There's another event which I had run into, which is at the White River Natural Resource Conservation District. They're celebrating 85 years of conservation, and that's on October 10th, so that's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And next Tuesday, the Public Utility Commission is having a public meeting. And that's at 7 o'clock in the evening, and you can attend that. And that they're the people who make all the rules about what we're going to do for energy and electricity. They're our interface with that.
And cell towers. Yeah.
Might be a pretty interesting meeting to go to.
Yeah. Hey, real quickly, we've only got 20 seconds left. I'm going to cut you off. Henry Greenzine is brought to you by Solaflect Bale, Royal Trail Works. That's Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. Henry, look forward to talking with you next week.
All right. We'll see you next week.